Malcolm Ross of Joseph K. You're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. We've got a busy WGXC Morning Show today. Rob Gellis will speak with Georgette Turner about the famous painters who lived in Columbia County during the 19th century. Plus, we'll hear the WGXC Congressional Report, tracking the votes, speeches, positions, and more from the representatives and the candidates of the 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional districts in New York State. And we'll hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and local better weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. And it all starts after the local news, which is next on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Connection and the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood.
Turn out or tune in to two of the world's greatest percussionists performing in Catskill at the Avalon Lounge on October 16th from 8 to 10 p.m. Composers and percussionists Tatsuya Nakatani and Bobby Previtt perform with a live web stream at WGXC.org. Turn out or tune in for Tatsuya Nakatani and Bobby Previtt performing at the Avalon Lounge in Catskill on Sunday, October 16th from 8 to 10 p.m. Find out more in the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about anything you hear here. Roger Hannigan-Gilson reports for the Times Union that ambulances with the Valencia Rescue Squad will reduce the use of sirens and emergency lights after a coalition of 13 national medical and first responder groups endorsed limiting the practice. The groups wrote a position paper, released in February, that cited a variety of studies suggesting that using lights and sirens when responding to calls had little effect on the medical outcome of the patient, while drastically increasing the possibility of a vehicle crash. Quote, "It is important that we are doing those things which we know definitively are helping our patients," unquote, said Valencia Rescue Squad Executive Director Scott Bowman. According to the paper, using lights and sirens saves emergency crews between 42 seconds and 3.8 minutes of time when responding to calls or transporting a patient, but increases the possibility of the ambulance crashing by 50%, or by 300% when transporting patients. Ambulance crashes can not only injure or kill EMS workers, but further injure patients, as well as endanger people in other vehicles. Falaise Rescue Squad Operations Manager Steve Meehan said the position paper confirmed an idea that had been talked about in the rescue squad for years. Quote, "We figured it was only a matter of time before this data would be publicized," unquote, he said. The Valencia Rescue Squad independently adopted a new policy, but no other rescue squads in Columbia or Greene counties have changed their policies, according to Meehan. The ultimate decision of whether to use lights and sirens will be up to the responding paramedic in charge. Meehan said it was not his job to, quote, "tie the hands of the clinicians. They are the ones that are making the clinical decisions in the back of the ambulance," unquote, he said. About 50 EMS agencies across the country have implemented the new recommendations and are collecting information with the National EMS Quality Alliance. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
Greta Jockum reports in the Berkshire Eagle that Donald Trump's big lie about the 2020 presidential election is having real effects on local election officials. In Western Massachusetts, election officials are being overwhelmed with requests for information about serial numbers of voting machines, voter ID numbers, and other issues. Lenox Town Clerk Carrie Sullivan said, and I quote, "I don't know how many different ways they want this information. It's the same numbers. They aren't going to change. What are you trying to accomplish by creating all this extra work for people? We're not hiding anything," end quote. The election information requests are being made around the country, fueled by Trump's lie that the 2020 election was full of fraud and stolen from the former president. The election was fair, as over 60 lawsuits were filed in the courts. Williamstown Town Clerk Nicole Beverly said, and I quote, "They are looking for very specific reports that, unless you have a certain type of software, we don't have the capacity to produce those reports," end quote. Great Barrington Town Clerk Jennifer Messina said, and I quote, "It's getting old. We've got big things on our plate right now," end quote. Messina said about the upcoming elections, and I quote, "We don't have time for this. It feels like they are threats," end quote. Documents about federal elections must be kept for 22 months, so the influx of information requests may ensue, or not, as many of the messages demand that the election information be retained longer. Messina said, and I quote, "They are basically saying they might take us to court. They are telling us we should not throw it away," end quote. Messina sent those emails to the town council for legal review. And you can read more about this story in the Berkshire Eagle.
Paul Kirby reports for the Daily Freeman that Opus 40 and Bard College have united in an effort to purchase the Harvey Fight House located adjacent to the monument, located in the hamlet of Highwoods and Saugerties in Ulster County, according to the president of Opus 40 Board of Directors. In a statement released on September 23rd, Jonathan Becker said, quote, "I am pleased to say that we are working with Bard College to purchase the house owned by Pat and Tad Richards and bring it into the Opus 40 site to be developed as a visitor center, library, and site for educational programming," unquote. The house is currently on the market, listed for $1.5 million. According to Becker, the Richards family prefers to sell the house to Opus 40 and Bard College, but both organizations must raise funds to buy the property before another buyer steps in. Becker said, quote, "We are hoping to raise $300,000 within the next month, if possible, in order to acquire the house at the amount and on the timetable that works for the Richards," unquote. Opus 40 and Bard College hope that local philanthropists will help with the purchase to, quote, "transition the property into a year-round community resource, a hub of economic revitalization, and site of cultural and natural bounty," unquote, Becker said. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman.
Joshua Solomon reports in the Times Union that Republican candidate for Governor Lee Zeldin is playing a game of political chicken with Governor Kathy Hochul on debates before voting starts. After calling Hochul, and I quote, "scaredy cat," end quote, for not committing to a debate with him, now that Hochul has agreed to one debate, he is not clear whether he will participate. Republican Zeldin, who represents Long Island in the U.S. Congress, said during a virtual news conference on September 22nd, and I quote, This offer of Kathy Hochul to just one debate at the end of October is a non-starter, end quote. He would not say plainly whether he would take part in the one debate Hochul agreed to. October 25th at Pace University, that would be broadcast by New York One and Spectrum News. Now a spokeswoman for Hochul's campaign is calling Zeldin chicken. Zeldin voted to overturn the results of the fair 2020 presidential election, and Hochul is currently facing controversy about paying more than other states for COVID-19 supplies to a campaign donor. Voting begins October 29th and continues through November 8th. And you can read the full story in the Times Union.
Clarence Fanto is reporting for the Berkshire Eagle that the reopening of the Stockbridge, Massachusetts Senior Center this week was a much-anticipated community event. The center is run by the Council on Aging and is located on the lower level of the town office building. It was sidelined by the COVID-19 pandemic for the past 30 months. Nearly half of Stockbridge's year-round residents are 60 or older. A lunchtime celebration on September 21st attracted nearly 100 seniors, said Chris McCarthy, council chairperson. Quote, the goal is to get people socializing again, get them out of their homes, getting them back together and to seeing their friends, acquaintances, and other people, unquote, town administrator Michael Canales said. Quote, we know that during COVID, a lot of people shut themselves in, unquote. Only limited programming had been provided during the pandemic with no social functions, he pointed out. Programs up and running again include yoga, classic bingo, and a special luncheon on the third Wednesday of the month with guest speakers. A representative of the Stockbridge Police Department will speak about public safety issues at the October 19th luncheon. The Senior Center is open to full-time and part-time residents 60 and older. Read more about this story in the Berkshire Eagle.
WNYT reports that Albany County Schools are starting a program to add cameras to the red stop signs on school buses to capture images of the license plates of cars passing buses when they are picking up or dropping off children. Officials say nearly 50,000 cars illegally pass stop school buses in New York every day. Albany County is working with the bus patrol company on the initiative, with the company taking 60% of the collected $250 fines and the county getting the other 40%. The South Colony School District is the first to get the cameras, with two buses outfitted so far. And you can read the full story at the WNYT website.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Renewable Weather Forecast. And we start each renewable weather forecast with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. Right now, the Gas Buddy website says the Mobil in Cairo has gas for $3.63 a gallon. That's the lowest figure in the county. Then we look at the air quality forecast, which is a 17, up very slightly from the 15 on Sunday and still in the very good range. The UV index is 3 for the second day in a row. That is on the low side of the moderate range. The National Weather Service in Albany says that Monday there's a 40% chance of showers, possibly a thunderstorm after 3 p.m. Otherwise, it'll be partly sunny with a high of 65, with a south wind 6 to 11 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 21 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Monday night, a 30% chance of showers is the forecast, mainly before 7 p.m. Then it turns partly cloudy with a low around 48 and a southwest wind around 8 miles per hour. Tuesday, there's a 30% chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms after 2 p.m. Otherwise, it's mostly sunny with a high of 64 and a south wind 5 to 8 miles per hour. Tuesday night, again, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms before 8 p.m. Partly cloudy skies, a low around 46, and a southwest wind 5 to 7 miles per hour, becoming west after midnight. Wednesday, there is a 40% chance of showers, mainly after 2 p.m. Otherwise, mostly sunny with a high of 59 and a low around 43. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears. Tune in all sorts of creative community voices on the radio at WGXC on Monday, September 26th, including at 9 a.m. on the WGXC Morning Show. Rob Gellis speaks with Georgette Turner about the famous painters who lived in Columbia County during the 19th century. Then hop on the Afrosonic Taxi at 10 a.m. with tracks from Salif Keita, Essence Kazooie, and Angelique Kidjo, among others. At 11 a.m., Brendan Donegan is playing favorites with the Talking Heads live from the WGXC Hudson studio in the basement of the First Presbyterian Church on Warren Street. And it's time for the Deep Three show after the local news at noon with music from Abby Lee T, Christine Webster, and Aphex Twin. There's new music from around the world at 2 p.m. on the Vital Weekly show, including tracks from Tomotsuga Nakamura, Vertonin, and Tetsue Akiyama. Tracking the Odds at 3 p.m. features the work of jazz drummer Susie Abera. At 4 p.m., the WGXC afternoon show is live from Western Massachusetts with host Kieran Riley. At 6 p.m., the All Together Now show features an interview with Reef Larson about, he's the founder of the Future of Small Cities Institute, and they've got a program Tuesday talking about the Hudson waterfront in Hudson and Beacon and Kingston. At 7 p.m., it's time for the Law and Disorder show, and then at 8 p.m., Rob Van Erve hosts Everything All the Time on 90.7 FM, WGXC.
Get a local event mentioned on All Together Now. Go to WGXC.org and click on Add an Event at the top of the page. And copy and paste the information about your event in the boxes. Let's all get involved in our community. See what's going on at WGXC.org in the community calendar.
The archetypal student-teacher romance gets turned on its head in the U.S. premiere of Hannah Moskowitz's Sexual Misconduct of the Middle Classes at the Catskills Bridge Street Theater, October 13th through 23rd. The new play was the winner of the 2021 Canadian Governor General's Literary Award for English Language Drama, and it's showing Thursdays through Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m. at the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
If you can't make your local town meetings but want to attend, WGXC can help. Currently, local volunteers make recordings and live web streams of the Catskill Town Meetings, the Hudson Common Council Meetings, and the Columbia County Board of Supervisor Meetings. If you miss the live web streams, volunteers post recordings of these meetings as soon as possible at WGXC.org on the newsroom page and in the audio archives. If you're going to local meetings and you have a phone in your pocket, you can help too. Email info@wgxc.org and WGXC will help you share recordings of local meetings and events. You can also use the free WGXC app, available in the App Store, to do your own live webcast from local events. Contact info@wgxc.org for more information about how you can help share valuable local information about your community with your friends and neighbors.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Monday, September 26th. Local early morning temperatures range from 52 in Jewett to 57 in Greenport. Regional average soil temperature is 60 degrees. Calm conditions this morning will lend to chances for patchy fog, likely gone by 10 a.m. Around 12 p.m., chances for rain enter the area and last until dark. We see a high temperature of 69 at 2 p.m. Overnight, we will see a low of 49 degrees. Then, tomorrow, slight chances of rain in the afternoon and a high of 68, which will linger across midday. 50 degrees overnight takes us into a Wednesday with a high of 65 and a rainy-looking afternoon. Thursday is looking dry and possibly windy with a high of only 61. Pollen levels for today will be low. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 3:38 a.m., low tide at 10:27 a.m., high tide again at 4:07 p.m., and low tide once again at 10:44 p.m. Continuing its autumnal slide, the river temperature will be 67 degrees today, and the current will be strong. Sunset today will be at 6:34 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:43 a.m. Looking way up, we see NASA is planning to strike an asteroid in an attempt to change its trajectory. Live coverage starts at 6 p.m. Solar wind speed is currently 296.9 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 8 MHz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is too quiet. The current sunspot number is 96. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the McPees of East Hampton, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
Early Electromix is a series to document the history of experimental electronic music from the 50s to the 80s. Pioneers who paved the way for what was to become techno, ambient, electronica, and most of what we are listening to. Essential Culture on air every Tuesday from 11 to 12 a.m.
Reports indicate that the best protection from radioactive fallout is a shelter.
Yet less than 5% of our population has one.
Do you?
Now, from Survival, one of the nation's leading manufacturers, comes an economical combination steel and concrete block, civil defense approved fallout shelter, offering maximum protection from nuclear fallout and falling debris.
FHA approved, you need nothing down. 5 years to pay.
Will you be prepared in case of atomic attack?
Will you and your loved ones be protected from nuclear fallout and falling debris?
For your family's protection from nuclear fallout, see a Survival shelter today.
Hello, this is Rob Gellis, and today I'm interviewing Hudson, New York native, Georgette Turner, and we'll talk about the bicentennial for Hudson that was in 1976. Your participation in it, you can explain to us how you were involved in it.
Well, yeah, I guess my history in art began with Olana. I went in the early years to, as a volunteer guide. And from that love of art and history, and especially impressed with Columbia County art, I just got to know people like Ruth Pawanka and Linda McLean. And through them, I was asked to do the Bicentennial exhibit. We did concentrate on 19th century art in Columbia County, which was a fabulous time to be an artist in the county. Economically, politically, socially, it was just a prime place for artists to work and be. So we chose 26 paintings, professional or self-taught artists, for our bicentennial exhibit. So that, let's see, our grand opening was July 5th, ran in through the 16th. I had a fabulous committee. Of course, I headed the group, but my co-chair was Marion Smith, the Greenport historian, which I'm sure people well know. My exhibit manager was Gil Anderson, who at that time was an art teacher at Taconic Hills. Tom Fleming, people know, he headed my guides committee. He got the guides together and, you know, to be with the exhibit during those 11 days. And I can never thank Linda McLean or Ruth Pawanka for sharing the expertise in helping us get the exhibit together. So I think I've answered your question.
Is there something maybe you could talk about? What you've done. I mean, you've obviously, it was art history. You could maybe talk a little bit about that. That seems to be a passion for you, I guess, the art in Columbia County.
Oh, yes, yes. It's after I retired from Olana, I guess it was 2003, I continued doing research on my own, mostly volunteer. I put together, that wasn't volunteer, but I put together the history of the Opera House through the newspapers down at the college. I think I covered from 1862 to 1900. It almost gives you a day-by-day program of what was happening at the Opera House then. I did some newspaper research for Olana at that time, and then a little later I helped with research at Columbia Historical Society, Columbia County Historical Society, and now I'm volunteering as a researcher for Albany Institute of History and Art. So this gives me a new look. I'm looking not necessarily on Columbia County art, but including now the Albany area. So that's kind of my background with that. What else could I?
Well, maybe you could highlight some of the important artists that came from the county. And in Olana, some of their paintings are in Olana. I know that, but there are different artists, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the important artists.
Oh, absolutely. There is a considerable list in our exhibit, the bicentennial exhibit. There were roughly four different stages of art that we chose, and of course, right after the Revolution, from 1800 to about, I'll say 1840, we have a lot of folk artists or itinerant artists coming through the area. You know, this was a port of entry, Hudson was at least, and we missed the becoming the capital by one vote. So things were happening not only in Hudson, but throughout the county. My next group we covered was from 1800, but like I just said, the travel and itinerant painting. From 1825 to 65, with the Erie Canal opening, it just increased river travel. Thomas Cole came up river and painted those three famous paintings, which was the beginning of the Hudson River School. Now, coming to this area was Henry Airy. He was born in Rhode Island. We're not sure where he got his education, but he certainly was professional. He went to Albany about 1830, moved to Catskill, and then came to Hudson, New York. Henry Airy is obviously a Hudson River painter, but he did portraits. He did fancy paintings, you know, designs on the steamboats, coal buckets, whatever. And he was a teacher in Hudson. He taught at the Female Academy. Of course, today we can go into the City Hall, Hudson City Hall, and see that huge painting of Washington, which was done by Henry Airy. It's after a painting done by Gilbert Sullivan, so it was a copy. Now, my next group was this Hudson River group that ended about 1865 after the Civil War. And my final group was sort of the mid to late century artists. Now, they included, of course, men like the Parton brothers, Arthur, Ernest, and Henry. They were actually born on Warren Street in what was later Zeichner's stationery store. We have Cortland Van Dusen and George McKinstry. And I was just reading the other day that McKinstry was quite popular in his lifetime. But today we hardly hear of him or see his paintings other than in local homes. George McKinstry did study in New York. He studied in Europe. Came back to Hudson, opened up an art studio, and he had students like Bert Phillips, who later would go out west and found the Taos, New Mexico Art Colony. And then we had, towards the end of this century, we had artists like Robert Fulton Ludlow. Ludlow lived in Claverick. His paintings could be uneven at times, although some felt that his paintings of steamboats were his best efforts. And then finally, we were lucky to get a painting by Josie Stevers. She was a woman that was living in Philmont. She married a gentleman from that area. And a lot of her paintings we see today. Of course, she was considered more a, you know, painting for herself, painting for her friends or neighbors. So certainly not professional, but she had to have had, you know, professional training somewhere along the line from her paintings. Maybe it was the Female Academy that she learned her art. We're not sure. We just know that she was from the South. Now, I can get into details of each artist that we chose, if you'd like.
Maybe we could highlight some of it. Was Sanford Gifford up here?
Absolutely. He lived just around the corner from the Parton brothers. Sanford Gifford. Today, I believe the farm market is where his home would have been. Gifford was born actually in Greenfield in Washington County. And a year old, his family moved to this area. And of course, with the influence of coal across the river and Henry area, certainly that was an influence on his work. But he did study professionally in New York City with, trying to find my papers here. It was 46 years ago I put this exhibit together, so I have to refer back. But he studied in New York City with John R. Smith. Now, in our exhibit, the folk art was quite fascinating. We had the Tenbrook twins. It's unsigned. It was painted in 1834. Now, it has been attributed to Amy Phillips due to the inscription on the back. Now, Phillips really didn't get recognition for his work until the 1950s. Through the years, his style would change and mature, and a lot of his work was attributed to other artists. So finally, the researchers are getting that back together again. But we know that Phillips was living in Rhinebeck in 1834. The painting of the Denbrook twins, William and Jacob, were 10 years old at the time of the painting, and they had moved from Claremont to Greenport in 1844. So the time period is starting to jive. Now, I can't prove it, but after our exhibit, I understood that Andy Williams, the singer, the famous singer, purchased the Denbrook twins, in the New York State City galleries, auction house, I should say. The next folk art, we can put it certainly in that area, unknown painting. It was done in 1830 on wood. And whoever the artist was certainly exposed to academic art. The painting was possibly done by Ira Goodell, who was living in Hudson in 1833, from 1829 to 1833. The painting is of Jacob W. Whitbeck. It's called the Whitbeck Gentleman. Whitbeck, of course, was a fifth generation Whitbeck, the family originally coming from Holland. Now, the next painting that we found was quite fascinating was one of Joseph Brandt, unknown painter. It belonged to the Hudson Masonic Lodge. They were gracious enough to let us borrow that painting. Of course, he called Joseph Brandt. Brandt was the son of a Mohawk chief, and he was a protege of William Johnson. Johnson sent him off to the Indian school over the Berkshires. But the story of this painting is quite unique to our history. Brandt actually saved the life of Captain John McKinstry, who was of Livingston. McKinstry was about to be burnt at the stake by Brandt's Indians, and McKinstry involuntarily gave the Masonic sign of distress, which Brandt, being a Mason, recognized immediately and stopped the Indians from killing McKinstry. So obviously McKinstry became friends with Brandt and would invite Brandt to meetings at the Hudson Lodge. So that was kind of unique. The next painting I found very interesting was a portrait of Cyrus Stebbins. It's unsigned, unfortunately. It was done in 1830, and it was owned by Christ Episcopal Church in Hudson. Stebbins was the pastor at the church from 1819 to 1832. He would then move on to Waterford. We can't authenticate it, but at the time, it was definitely thought by some historians to be the work of Francis Edmonds. Edmonds was a genre painting born in Hudson, New York, of the Quaker families. It exhibits all of the characteristics of the Edmonds style. And we know Edmonds and Stebbins were friends, contemporaries. when Edmonds was in Europe, he would write home to Stebbins. Edmonds, by the way, was a cashier at the Hudson River Bank, but a noted, genre painting. Beautiful work, just beautiful work, sort of the, it gives you touches of Dutch style. Now, getting into the more trained artists, we had a huge painting of Mr. and Mrs. Sherman Griswold. The painting went from floor to ceiling. By the way, the exhibit was held at Columbia Green Gallery, Columbia Green College Gallery, I should say. So it went from ceiling to floor, attributed to James E. Johnson. Now, this painting was done about 1837. It's a life-size portrait of the Griswolds of Spencertown. Griswold was originally from Connecticut, but moved to Spencertown late 18th century. He would purchase land northwards in Chatham, and after married Lydia Griswold in 1820. Now, the original name of this painting was Salting the Sheep. In the background, you can see the Hatfield Farm, which was owned by Griswold. Now, getting to Johnson, he was a very competent artist, so he had to have had training. He was born in Washington County and came to Kinderhook in 1846 and did many portraits in the area. Now, he did a lovely painting of his wife. You can see the affection that he had for his setter in this painting. It was done in 1853. And it belongs to the Columbia County Historical Society. He married Sarah Ann in 1852. And the census records has James E. Johnson in Kinderhook as early as 1846. Now, Sarah's father built the house that's now the Union Bank in Kinderhook in 1825. So by 1855, the census has Johnson living listed as an artist. So he was spending full time on his paintings at that point. Now, Johnson painted most of Sarah's family, as well as people of means within the area. I found most of fascinating. Art-wise and historical-wise, was the portrait that Johnson did of Sarah's brother, Peter H. Van Vleck. This was done in 1853, of course, and it was owned by Mr. and Mrs. Albert Callan, Jr., of course, of the Chatham Courier. Now, Peter, the subject of this painting, was a brother-in-law, as I said. After going out west to California, he returned about 1850, and he purchased the Kinderhook Sentinel. The name was then changed to Kinderhook Rough Notes, and after Peter died, he moved the business, the newspaper business, was moved to Valencia. Its final move in the early 20th century was to Chatham, and now we know it as the Chatham Courier. So you can see why Albert Callan owned that painting. Now, the Hudson River School, of course, we did touch over Sanford Gifford, but we had a church, of course, that was a landscape from Alana. It was painted, it's a Winterstein painted the year before he broke ground for Alana. By the way, Church was well aware of that view from Alana, as we know it today, as early as 1845. We have their sketches by both coal and church out of the ground to the line. Now, the next painting, I did mention Henry Airy in Hudson. One of his famous students was John Bristol of Hillsdale. He was born in Hillsdale, 1826. The painting we had in the exhibit was the Catskills from Hillsdale. It was done in 1874. It belongs to the Hillsdale Library. Now, as I said, Bristol studied with Airy, but he was mostly self-taught. He had early struggles, but became a member of the National Academy of Design in 1875. He married a Great Barrington girl, but made their home in New York City. Now, he was that, like, second-generation Hudson River artist, where he's dealing with luminism, with atmosphere, with color, and love to include water in his landscapes. The painting, like I said, belonged to the Hillsdale Library. Now, I do have a line here, but we had a South Bay painting, Hudson, New York, by Thomas Addison Richards. It's dated 1845. Now, Thomas Addison Richards was born in London. He came to Hudson, New York in 1831. The family would later move to Georgia. And by 1844, Richards was leaving Charleston, North Carolina, to study in New York City. So this 1845 painting was probably just a return visit to Hudson. But that South Bay was a very popular spot for the artists, from the Partons, Sanford, Gifford, just on and on. They all seem to gravitate towards that area. In this 1845 painting, by the way, you do not see the New York Central Railroad tracks, but done in 1845, the railroad hadn't gone through the mouth of the bay until 1851. Later, Parton would do a painting of the bay, and it was dated 1865, yet he chose to eliminate the railroad tracks going across the bay, so I guess it was up to the artist's discretion. Now, there was a third Parton brother. We didn't have any of his work in exhibit, but the younger brother, Henry, of course, studied with his two older brothers, Arthur and Ernest. He was born in Hudson, on Warren Street, 1858. He was noted also for his luministic skies, his dramatic landscapes. All three brothers, talented men. Now, the next artist that appears in Hudson is George McKinstry. We had Lake Scene in our exhibit. Now, we think it was Copaque Lake. It was one of his favorite spots to paint. But he did portraits, charcoal, line drawings. McKinstry was born in 1855, died in Hudson in 1919. He did study at the Art Students League in New York City and then went to Paris for studies. When he returned from Paris about 1881, he opened a Hudson studio. And of course, that's where he probably taught young Bert Phillips. Now, the history of McKinstry, he unfortunately was very well known in his lifetime. Today, we hardly hear anything about him. He did cut his art career short. His father owned a drugstore in Hudson. Everyone knew McKinstry's drugstore. But originally, he had a partner, Rossman. So when Rossman left the drugstore, George joined his father in the running of the family drugstore. Like I said, it was a really great year, century.
Again, Georgette, I want to thank you so much for coming on my program.
Okay, goodbye then.
Here is this week's WGXC Congressional Report, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives and candidates for the 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional seats in New York. Current Democrat Representative Paul Tonko from the 20th District votes with the positions of President Joe Biden 100% of the time, according to the 538.com website. Republican Elise Stefanik, currently representing the 21st District, votes with Biden's positions 19.3% of the time. Democrat Pat Ryan, who now represents the 19th District.
Leanne Caldwell and Theodore Meyer explain in the Washington Post the possible reasons Representative Elise Stefanik announced last week she would run again for the position of House Republican Conference Chair. That would be giving herself a demotion if Republicans retake the House of Representatives, as they expect to. Stefanik would move down from the number 3 spot in the House GOP leadership to the number 4 in the hierarchy if Republicans are in the majority. Why? 3 other Republicans recently announced they would run for the number 3 spot as White House whip. So she would face more competition than for conference chair, the position she now has, with Representative Byron Donalds from Florida as the only competition. And being whip means you have to build consensus between moderate and conservative Republicans, which is not Stefanik's specialty these days. One senior Republican aide said of the whip position, and I quote, "It's going to be a really, really difficult job," end quote. As conference chair, and I quote, "You're just lobbing bombs at the administration," end quote. And just lobbing bombs at the administration is what Stefanik is doing now, and makes her better suited to become a vice presidential candidate for someone such as former President Donald Trump if he runs again in 2024. A source close to Stefanik said, and I quote, "Trump has encouraged Stefanik to run again, and he is very happy with the job she's done," end quote. Read the full story in the Washington Post. News 10 Albany reports that incumbent Democrat Paul Tonko has proposed a WMHT debate for the 20th Congressional District election this fall, and Republican challenger Liz Joy wants multiple debates. Joy said, and I quote, "I'm looking forward to debating Paul, and our campaign is currently in discussions with multiple organizations that have proposed debates, including WMHT. Unlike Paul Tonko, who in 2020 refused to debate me when over 100 business owners requested a forum, we need to hear directly from Paul as to why he supports policies that are making New York unaffordable and unsafe with skyrocketing crime and weak borders allowing deadly fentanyl to flow into the country," end quote. Because of Joy's participation in the rally in Washington, D.C., January 6, 2021, Tonko seems eager to debate this fall. Tonko said on Wednesday, and I quote, "Those running for the People's House should be held to account and open to public scrutiny. My opponent organized a bus trip to the Capitol on January 6th, where police officers died and insurrectionists tried to overturn an election. She has also expressed support for total abortion bans, even in cases of rape and incest. These are extreme views that are well out of touch with Capital Region voters, and they deserve to be scrutinized," end quote. So far, there are no specifics, except using the local public television station WMHT as a venue. See the News 10 website for more details on this story. Alex Galt reports for Northern New York newspapers that the National Rifle Association has given Representative Elise Stefanik an A+, and given her opponent, Democrat Matt Castelli, an F, and he is upset about his grade. Castelli, a former CIA officer and director of counterterrorism at the National Security Council, who served in both the Obama and the Trump White Houses, says he is a gun owner. And he says he would not support a ban on assault weapons sales that many Democrats are talking about in Congress. According to the Adirondacks Enterprise, at a September 14th town hall meeting, Costelli said he prefers legislation to keep all weapons out of the hands of those who would use them to harm others. People he defined as, and I quote, cop killers, kid killers, domestic abusers, and terrorists, end quote. Costelli also said he opposes the recent gun control legislation passed in New York. He says the National Rifle Association never asked him anything about his position on guns and cannot understand why they would give him an F grade. He said, and I quote, the NRA is misleading the public with the claim that they rank political candidates based on voting records, public statements, and their response to an NRA PFV questionnaire. The corrupt NRA has abandoned its original values of responsible gun ownership, cut funding to gun training and safety, and now represents corporate interests, not law-abiding gun owners, end quote. Costelli is challenging Stefanik in New York's 21st Congressional District, which includes Rensselaer County, in the election October 29th through November 8th. And you can read the full story at NNY360.com. Former Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan was sworn in as new congressperson in New York's 19th Congressional District on September 13th and cast his first vote in the past week. The 19th Congressional District had gone months without any representation as Antonio Delgado resigned to become Lieutenant Governor, and Ryan won a special election in August against Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro to fill the final weeks of his term. Ryan's first vote, the day he was sworn in, was, and I quote, to extend by 19 days the authorization for the special assessment for the Domestic Trafficking Victims Fund, end quote, which passed unanimously. On September 15th, Ryan voted for the Whistleblower Protection Improvement Act, which passed 221 to 203, and would establish, modify, and expand certain whistleblower protections for federal employees. On September 19th, Ryan voted for the Peace Corps Reauthorization Act, which passed 290 to 125. On September 21st, Ryan voted for the Presidential Election Reform Act from California Democrat Zoe Lofgren and Wyoming Republican Senator Liz Cheney. The bill would confirm that the vice president's role in overseeing the Electoral College count after each presidential election is purely ministerial and passed with a 229 to 203 vote, with only 9 Republicans joining all Democrats with yay votes. Locally, Democrat Paul Tonko voted for the last 3 bills, while Republican Elise Stefanik voted against them. Go to the House of Representatives voting webpage to see all of Ryan's first votes.
This has been the WGXE Congressional Report, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives and candidates for the 19th, 20th, and 21st congressional seats in New York. Go to the WGXE Newsroom, wgxc.org, for more information.
This year's general election in New York begins October 29th and ends November 8th. October 14th is the last day to register to vote and to postmark an application to vote in the general election. Those mailed-in applications to vote must be received by the Board of Elections by October 19th. Anyone honorably discharged from the military or who became a naturalized citizen after October 14th may register in person at the County Board of Elections office up until October 29th. Applications to vote by absentee ballot must be received by October 24th, although military absentee ballot applications are accepted through October 29th. Anyone can apply for an absentee ballot in person through November 7th. Absentee ballots must be postmarked by November 8th and received by the County Board of Elections.